court will proceed to the second case of the day, Morphin versus the City of East Chicago. Mr. Bodensteiner.
Good morning. May it please the court. This case involves the Democratic primary election in East Chicago in almost 4 years ago now, in May of 1999. And while there were a number of offices at issue, this concerns primarily the race for mayor, where the incumbent, Mr. Pastrick, was being challenged by Steve Stiglitz. While in the context of a political campaign, we obviously expect each side to take actions against the other, each side to take politically motivated actions against the other side in an effort to win. And I might add that while this was the Democratic primary that we're talking about, it is in effect the real election. In other words, the winner of this primary was virtually assured of a victory in the general election in November.
Should that alter our focus in some way?
I'm sorry?
Is that just an interesting note, Mr. Bodensteiner, or should it wouldn't alter our focus? Would it whether the primary or the reality that it's in, or the likely winner? I mean,
it wouldn't alter the reality except to say this is in essence the election.
Yeah, but you're not suggesting we would treat primary violations it consider that a lesser order?
No, not at all, Your Honor. The problem here, and the reason we're here, is because it is the plaintiff's position that this case represents an abuse of police power by the incumbent. And as I indicated, while you expect a lot of action, including tricks, et cetera, in the course of a campaign, what you don't expect is that there will be an abuse of the police power by the side that has control of the police department. Now, in this situation, there are a number of key actors and departments that I will explore briefly. First of all, there's the election board, the county election board. And the duties and responsibility of the board and the staff are spelled out generally in the Indiana Code beginning at 3-6-5-1. And basically, the election board under subpart 14 conducts the elections. Under subpart 31 of that statute, it investigates election law violations, and under subpart 33, the police get involved upon request by the board. Now, the election board in this case, a five-member board, was essentially controlled by Mayor Pastrick, with two Republican members generally supporting him, and then an individual, Justin Murphy, an attorney, who at this time was acting not as attorney for the election board, a position he had held in the past, but he was acting primarily as a proxy for one of the board members, Ms. Anton, who also supported Pastrick. Then there's the election board staff, which was controlled by Stiglitz in the sense that he, as the chair of the Democratic Party in the county, got to appoint the head of that staff. And I think what the evidence showed here is that there was basically distrust between some members of the board and the actual staff of the election board. Mr. Morphin was one of the members of the election board staff. Then the county sheriff, whose name was Buncich at that time, was an individual who supported the incumbent Mayor Pastrick. The Lake County prosecutor, his name is Bernie Carter, was supporting Stiglitz. The East Chicago police and its chief, Chief Alcala, were basically under the control of the incumbent Pastrick, and Alcala was a supporter of his. The fire department in East Chicago was under the control of a Mr. Dawson, and that too was basically under the control of the incumbent.
Was Dawson and Atala appointed by the mayor?
Yes. And then there's an individual who is not a government official, the mayor's son, Kevin Pastrick, who was actively involved in the key events on the eve of the election, May 3rd of 1999. Now, what we had here over the course of the month or so, actually a little more than a month prior to this primary, beginning on March 22, 1999, a Mr. Smith was arrested while leafleting in a neighborhood. He was once a plaintiff. His case got settled. On April 16th, a Ms. Johnson was taken into custody for several hours, and there was a fight over whether it was really an arrest or not. She, too, was a plaintiff. That matter was resolved by settlement. Then, on May 3rd of 1999, the eve of the election, at a polling place that we referred to as a barbershop, there was an arrest of a Mr. Crawford, and that too led to a fight over whether or not it was actually an arrest or not. That matter has not been appealed. A Mr. French was in fact arrested at the polling place. He was called in. He was called in by Crawford to assist him in setting up the machines that evening on the eve of the election. And then later that evening, after Mr. Morphin learned that there had been an allegation of tampering against French, he was in East Chicago, and he then went to the barbershop or the polling place for the purpose of inspecting the machines to see whether or not there had in fact been any tampering. Mr. Llewellyn, who was the chief inspector in the fire department, was not involved in the events of May 3rd, 1999. On April 17th, his automobile, a city-issued automobile, had been searched, and that then led to his suspension beginning on April 21, a 21-month suspension, and he was then brought back in January of 2000. Now, out of all of these arrests, there were never any charges filed.
He was suspended with pay, is that correct?
He was suspended, and that's part of the issue. He was suspended with base pay, but not what amounted to, over these 21 months, $12,000 of, it was a portion of his check for on-call time. And so, yes, he had his base pay, but he didn't have his full salary, and he lost the automobile that was one piece of the compensation package, an automobile that
that was available for personal use, the automobile?
Yes. Under that scheme at the fire department, it was a car that he had at all times, basically. So if we start then by focusing on Mr. Morphin, and I think one of the keys here with respect to his claim is he was an official of the election board, and he comes to the scene of this alleged tampering for which there had already been an arrest. And basically, he's there to do his job. And he runs into a police officer, Mr. Kovacs, who says that he has taken control of this scene. And so there's an immediate conflict there in this sense, that Morphin is there as the election board employee or official. The election board has the authority under state law to run the elections and to deal with violations. Morphin comes in, presents credentials. You know, they knew who he was. He wasn't a thug off the street. And what he gets permission from the officer to check these two machines and comes to the conclusion that there had in fact been no tampering. Then you have a dispute over whether or not he actually touched the machine when he shouldn't have touched the machine. He says he touched a extension cord to plug it in so he could in fact check the machine. You then have this escalating. Officer Kovat says he called the police department, he talked to the chief, he talked to the chief's attorney, that is Mr. Ryan, the legal advisor for the police department, and no one really knew how to deal with the situation where you've got the police and the election board official on the scene to deal with the voting machines. And part of the problem here from our perspective is that instead of resolving these doubts by going to the election board, what happened is they basically told Kovacs, do your job, and he ends up making an arrest, he and another officer make an arrest of Morphin under circumstances where the police, including their legal advisor, didn't really know the relative authority of the police and the election board official.
Well, what about the officer? Assuming he was wrong, what is it outside the range of reasonable police conduct for the street officer in light of the context he made to conduct himself in the way he did?
I think it is, Your
Constitutionally
Honor.
Constitutionally wrong. I mean,
right. I understand. I think it is, Your Honor, because it seems to me that when you're making an arrest based on probable cause, you've got these doubts about what the relative authority was. The reasonable action would have been to not make the arrest, given the fact
that... You don't want to penalize an officer who has some question about probable cause for checking with superiors, do we? I mean, is that the message you want to send out? You either better know probable cause, because if you check it, you may put yourself at risk for questioning, you know, the reasonableness of your conduct.
Well, I don't know that we would send that message or not, but basically one of the things the officer said is that he didn't rely on the advice that he got, and basically the advice he... In other words, what we're saying here is from the very top of the police department, the message was, go ahead and make the arrest, instead of the chief intervening and saying, given all these questions, we should err on the side of not making an arrest because the only way to make that arrest valid is if there was probable cause for believing that Morphin had done something wrong. And
is that what they told him, or did they just, you know, put their hands in their pockets and shrugged their shoulders? I mean, they didn't give many advice.
No, the point is they didn't intervene and stop it. The way it was phrased was, do your job as a police officer, and knowing
that's not giving that's not performing the duties of command right there.
Right.
That's different than simply intervening. It's not performing the duties of command.
I think what we're saying there, Your Honor, is that it's the chief not intervening to stop an illegal action.
Not to give appropriate direction to the officer.
Right. And stop this arrest before it happens.
Now, is the law clearly established that the police chief has some special kind of obligation in a situation like that to respond to his officer's inquiry and not sit there with his hands in his pockets and say nothing?
The law in this circuit is clearly established that officers cannot place their head in the sand and ignore violations.
My question to you is there a special obligation with respect to officers in command giving advice to subordinates?
I think, Your Honor, that the cases don't raise it as a special duty in the higher ranks, but I think where it comes into play is that it's more obvious that the higher ranks have the ability to correct as opposed to maybe a co-worker.
But if that is not the law, doesn't that set up a situation where the higher ranks can be in a see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil situation and let the lower ranks take the burden of responsibility for the matter?
Well, I think in this situation there you would say yes as the chief. The main thing here, then, I think, is that the chief had the opportunity. It's not a situation where the chief didn't know it was happening. The chief knows we've got an unclear situation, an officer calling in, and instead of intervening and stopping it, and I think that duty is clear, whether it's a chief or a non-chief, the duty to intervene and stop the violation is clear.
Yeah, but Officer Kovacs remained the defendant in this case, right?
That's right, Your Honor.
I mean, your discussion with Judge Ripple seems to focus, understandably, on the responsibilities of command.
Right.
But I still have some concern about the reasonableness of an officer who, faced with a difficult situation, seeks some inquiry, and it may be failed to be delivered, and we're saying the civil liability attaches to that kind of seemingly, initially, responsible conduct in calling for advice.
Right. We have an officer who unfortunately doesn't get the guidance.
Right.
Yet, every police officer who engages in making an arrest has to arrest only if there's probable cause.
How difficult was this officer's job? I mean, if he hadn't listened to the mayor's son, would this have been a difficult call for a halfway intelligent officer?
I think it would not have been a difficult call, Your Honor, and I think that was part of the problem. He's being urged by the mayor's son, and actually there's some indication Justin Murphy was involved through the telephone.
So if on summary judgment we take the facts as alleged, in the most favorable light of the non-moving party, this officer is still in because the facts are he listened to the mayor's son and just didn't look at the facts of the case.
Right.
Jury may decide otherwise, but that's the situation, right?
That's right, Your Honor. And it's our position that he was influenced by the mayor's son, and he goes ahead and acts not knowing whether there's probable cause or not. And that, we believe, it makes him liable as well as the chief who didn't provide the guidance that was needed. And just very briefly, then, there's also, you know, factual questions about whether there was excessive force used in his arrest. And finally, with respect to Llewellyn, just briefly, I see the light is on. There the key question, in a sense, becomes whether or not this falls on the discharge side of the line or on the suspension with full pay side of the line. This court in the Townsend case had said a suspension with full pay does not trigger due process protection. On the other hand, a discharge clearly does. If this is a discharge controlled by Loudermill, then there was a violation of due process. If this is not a discharge controlled by Townsend, then there's no due process claim. And just very briefly on that, it's our position that this case is different than Townsend, where the person received full salary. What that person lost was an opportunity to possibly get some overtime. In contrast, Llewellyn lost, I think it was like 10 or 12% of his salary, for a period of 21 months. And after 21 months passed, he suddenly reinstated. And the only thing that's changed is we now have a new chief in the fire.
If an officer was disabled and entitled to remain on the payroll, would he or she get on-call time?
An officer was disabled? Well,
21 months, yeah. I'm just trying to see how locked in that entitlement
mm-hmm.
would be.
I don't know the answer to that because I'm not aware of any circumstances where that happened, and it would intend.
Well, it could easily occur, though.
It could, absolutely.
It's a dangerous position to hold.
Absolutely, and it would be our position that became a part of that officer's salary, and therefore that should be continued during that period as well. Now, the defendants rightly say while he was suspended, he wasn't having to be on call, but of course he wasn't working at all either, and it wasn't that he wasn't willing. And so the point here is simply that he lost a substantial portion of his compensation package between the on-call pay as well as the vehicle.
Before you sit down, Mr. Bodenstein, one other question. With respect to Officer Kovacs, at one point in his deposition, he testifies that he never was aware of a conversation with
Mr. Pastry.
Yeah, he does not seem to be aware that there was a conversation, a telephone conversation. On the other hand, I'm sorry, it's your plaintiff who testified.
Morphin, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right. Morphin's testimony was that he did not hear or see Kovacs on the telephone.
And yet you are alleging, despite your client saying never heard of the telephone conversation, that Chief Akala is into this through that telephone conversation. Am I correct?
Right. Morphin is not the source of information, Your Honor, on the Kovacs, Akala, Ryan conversation. But Kovacs, Ryan, and Akala all testified to that. Morphin doesn't testify that it didn't happen. His testimony was, I didn't see that or hear that.
So it would just simply be a question for the jury to sort out that whole thing. sometimes in a situation like that, people's perceptions are different.
Right.
I see. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bonesteiner. Mr. DeBonis?
May it please this honorable court. I'm appearing for the City of East Chicago, and it is my duty to point out to the court the reasons why summary judgment ought to be sustained in favor of the city. The sole basis for imputing Section 1983 liability to the city in both of these cases are the acts of persons who are deemed to be decision makers high enough to make these decisions under the PEMBAR rule. That means that Chief Alcala and Chief Dawson's act are under scrutiny. With respect to Chief Alcala on the claims of Appellant Morphin, the plaintiff has tacitly admitted that Alcala was not at the scene of the barbershop, that he really had no information other than what Kovacs transmitted to him over the telephone, and that he handed that telephone to the police legal advisor. The police legal advisor could not resolve the legal issue of whether or not Morphin had any authority to be in the polling place. And those persons left it to the discretion of the officer on the scene to determine whether an arrest should be made. Now, it should be pointed out that Officer Kovacs here is the criminal technician of the police department. And it is given short shrift by the plaintiff the fact that another arrest had been occurred to a gentleman named French, who previously had been a plaintiff in the case, who was in the polling place and seen by witnesses fooling around with wiring under a voting machine. The problem with French was that he had no authority to be in there because, first, he was a convicted felon, and second, he was related to a candidate on the ballot, both of which forbid him to be in a polling place under state law.
When was Mr. French arrested?
Some moments before Morphin. Probably, my recollection is a half hour or so. There was enough time for French to have been removed and booked, and then the police criminalist, Officer Kovacs, arrived and began his work. So there was some space of time. This was clearly a crime scene. By the way, these facts have been judicially determined as to French because summary judgment was entered by Judge Sharp on his arrest, and he has not appealed. So the court, with all due respect, we believe, must take those facts with regard to the French arrest as established. Now, Kovacs, in control of a crime scene, there's no dispute that he's dusting machines for fingerprints, that he is trying to establish the extent to which persons unauthorized under the law, and these are felonies under the Indiana Election Code, were messing with machines. Enter Morphin. Morphin announces that he is the mechanic of the election board. He is not a law enforcement officer. He is someone who sets up machines and tries to make them work. Morphin's undisputed testimony is that he's not a specialist in any computer technology. He goes through a short training course by the manufacturer of the machine, and he admitted under his deposition testimony that he was no more capable of judging the effect of various things on the machine than any of one of us. The point is, Morphin's authority to interfere with a crime scene cannot be sustained. And Kovacs, being an experienced criminalist, would know that. Now, Morphin does not challenge, as Mr. Bodensteiner pointed out, that a telephone conversation took place between Kovacs and police headquarters. That fact is without dispute. The fact that Morphin chose not to remember it does not place it in dispute. That means that Kovacs acted reasonably as an officer. Secondly, it must be remembered that Morphin admitted in his deposition that he was told by a police officer to leave. Before that, when he first entered, Kovacs told him to move away from the machine because obviously any touching of that equipment would have rendered the ability to obtain fingerprints worthless. I think we've all gone through the Simpson case and other things that I think sensitize the police and everyone to how important it is to maintain the integrity of a crime scene. Thirdly, Morphin makes no bones about the fact that when the officer told him to move away, he also was given permission by the officer to look at the machine, but he was told not to touch. Morphin did that. He looked at the machine. The officer cooperated with him. But then he took the power cord and plugged it in. Number one, the power cord now cannot be dusted for fingerprints because Morphin has now altered it.
Did he announce he was going to do that?
And he didn't wait for permission, Your Honor. That's a crucial fact. He simply says, I'm going to plug it in now, and he plugs it in. Kovacs, who's over at the other machine, can't respond.
Why do we know that he can't respond?
Because I believe he said so. It was done in one act.
Why is that an issue for the jury?
It is not an issue for the jury because I don't believe any reasonable juror could have concluded that Kovacs gave his consent. And the reason for that is that Kovacs is on the telephone at the time, a phone conversation the plaintiff does not challenge, talking to the chief. Kovacs' testimony, which is also unchallenged, is that when he saw during that conversation the plug going into the wall, he put the phone down and proceeded to make the arrest. That's why there is probable cause here. That's why even if Officer Kovacs, under the standards of this court, is wrong, he's entitled both to probable cause and qualified immunity. I want to go on to a couple of other things, Your Honor.
Would one of them please be the Chief Akala situation? Why isn't there enough evidence to go to the jury on whether Chief Akala, in fact, had a policy of simply keeping his head low?
Well, Your Honor, everyone admits there's a legitimate question to be asked here about Morphin's authority. The chief recognized that and put the legal advisor on the phone. I don't think the law requires the chief, who's not there, to substitute his judgment for the officers who are there, and there was more than one. I don't believe there is any law that requires, in this circuit, that requires an officer to intervene when the officer is not present and does not observe.
Even if that officer is the officer in command.
That's correct, Your Honor. Maybe he has the power, but it is our contention that he, as a matter of law, did not have the duty under these circumstances.
Did not have the duty.
Correct.
You think that should be the state of the law?
It is, Your Honor.
Now, assume arguendo.
I'm not assuming, Your Honor.
I am. Please.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Stay with me.
Sure.
You interrupted me twice already. I'd rather not be interrupted a third time, sir.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Suppose that indeed the chief had a policy of being unresponsive to officers in the field like that. Would that not be attributable to the municipality and be enough to keep the municipality in this case?
No, unless it were established there were some affirmative legal duty under state law or under constitutional law for him to do so.
I'm assuming that. Arguendo. Yeah.
If there is, and I know of none, that argument could be made. Chief Alcala had a difficult situation here. Again, I do not believe it should be the policy of the law to require a chief to intervene when he's not there to judge the conduct of the people who are presumably perhaps committing a crime. The same thing applies, we think, to Alcala's conduct in the search. Alcala got the legal advisor involved. This time, the legal advisor had more guidance to give. There's no question that the car was owned by the city.
In that case, if I recall, sir, the chief did not say, do your job. He just turned it over to the legal advisor. The legal advisor did give substantive advice.
I think that's correct.
So there was really,
yes.
There's really no,
I don't
reason
believe
for the, no reason to suggest that the Chief Akala was derelict in his duty in that case because he heard the legal advisor give advice.
We think that's correct, Your Honor. The plaintiff doesn't agree with that.
I understand, but see, my point is, isn't there a distinction between the chief's conduct in those two situations? You know, it's a very, you've got a pretty good case there. But I'm saying, isn't it a different situation when the chief of police says to a poor guy out in the field, hey, do your job?
Well, Your Honor, our contention is that they are not different. That Alcala, as the highest ranking operational officer of the police department, may have had the power to do things, but the law in this context should not have imposed on him as a matter of law the duty to do so. Had Alcala been standing there in the polling place, perhaps things might have been different. Your Honor, if I may touch on the... I think the red light is on.
It is. I mean, you'll be moving into the time of co-counsel.
Yeah, I'm just going to say that I think this record is abundantly clear that on-call pay is not included in the state statute that says that on leave, firefighters get their base salary, first-class firefighters get their base salary plus health insurance. If this were a disability situation, I believe the statutes of the state of Indiana would require only the base salary. Even Llewellyn himself characterized in his deposition this as extra pay, not part of his base salary. He was given adequate notice, and Your Honor, as counsel has admitted, if he has been granted what the law gave him a property interest in, namely only the base pay, then he has no claim under due process. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Bosch.
Good morning, Your Honors. As a quick follow-up to the arrest of Morphin, I'd just like to point out that I believe the record would substantiate that Kovacs was, in fact, calling the chief for some advice because he was not sure of Morphin's authority. The decision to arrest came when Morphin exceeded the permission that the evidence technician had given him. And having said that, I'd like to move to Mr. Llewellyn, who's been kind of ignored so far this morning. John Llewellyn was the chief fire inspector for the East Chicago Fire Department, still is. One night in early April, he was at a party a few blocks from his house. Lieutenant Chavarria of the East Chicago Police Department received a phone call from a confidential informant. That confidential informant told him that John Llewellyn was at a party on Drummond Street, that he was collecting absentee ballots, he was putting them in a particular colored bag, and he was driving his East Chicago Fire Department car. Collecting absentee ballots is a felony in the state of Indiana if you don't have other legal permission to do so. With that, Lieutenant Chavarria called Chief Alcala, who referred him to the police department legal advisor. He had the police department chase down the fire chief, who was out of town, Chief Dawson. Dawson was told by Lieutenant Chavarria that there's some problems here. We think that Llewellyn has some ballots, absentee ballots in his car. Do you have an objection to us opening up his fire department trunk? Chief Dawson says, no, I don't have a problem with that, but I'm not there. Call Chief Vanslow. He'll let you in. Dawson also testified that he believed that he had the authority to do that. He believed that as the chief of the fire department, he had the authority to give the policeman permission to open up a fire department car, and I think that makes sense. He's the chairman, or he's an officer of a corporation, and he tells another officer of that same corporation that, yes, you can open the corporate car. There was probable cause.
Mr. Bosch, when reading your brief, I was impressed by the fact you do rely a great deal on the fact there was probable cause, as opposed to this consent argument. They are really two different arguments. Did you argue consent in the district court as well as probable cause?
Yes, and I think the district court referred to the privacy, although I think it was called the expectation of privacy in its decision. Yes, we did.
So you're relying on both of those?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay, realizing they're separate arguments.
Yes. I have nothing further, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bosch. Mr. Greco?
Good morning, Your Honor. I represent Kevin Pastrick. He's the only non-state actor involved in this case. That's uncontradicted. If I may, Judge Ripple, let me address something that you had brought up to Mr. Bodensteiner. With all due respect, sir, you indicated that hadn't Kovacs listened to the mayor's son, or some implying that Kovacs did listen to the mayor's son. First of all, Kevin Pastrick denies making those statements. Only two witnesses say that he did make those statements. One was Morphin, and the other one was Roy Schaefer. Those two witnesses disagree as to whether Kevin Pastrick was inside the barbershop or not. Morphin puts him outside the barbershop. Schaefer puts him inside the barbershop.
Mr. Greco, why is that a classic jury question then, as to the degree of participation of your client in these events?
Judge, the question of whether he was inside or outside the barbershop really, in my opinion, is not that material to the outcome of this case. Okay? But assuming for a moment, as you must, that Kevin Pastrick made those comments, Kovacs testified he never heard the comments, and had he heard them, they wouldn't have influenced his decision in arresting Morphin at all. In this particular case, the plaintiffs have failed in their burden to show that my client was a state actor, that his comments led to the arrest of Mr. Morphin. In fact, the plaintiff in his brief at the bottom of page 4 in his reply brief says, plaintiff acknowledges that point by asking this question: why did Kovacs, after talking to Ryan, arrest Morphin?
Suppose, sir, and I'm again here, just I know it's just not your position, but let's just suppose that your client did give direction to the police officer in the barber shop that evening, and did it either at the behest of his father, or at least in such a way as to give those present the impression that he did it at the behest of his father. Wouldn't he then be a state actor? Isn't he then simply his father's the cat's paw in effect here?
Judge, if those were the facts.
If they were.
And we're supposing I certainly think that presents a major argument on behalf of the plaintiff, yes.
So but your problem is we don't get there because you don't think the facts support it, all right?
That's correct. That's absolutely correct, sir. And the reason why I don't think we get there is the Edmondson case. The Edmondson case holds a two-pronged test. And that test, as soon as I find my notes here, it says that the deprivation must be caused by the exercise of some right or privilege created by the state, or a rule of conduct imposed by the state, or, this is the key part as far as Kevin Pastrick is concerned, or by a person for whom the state is responsible to or for. In this record, there's no testimony that the state was responsible in any way to or for Kevin Pastrick. Secondly, the second part of the test, which I think the plaintiff, Morphin, has failed completely, the defendant, quote, must be fairly said to be a state actor. And I don't believe the evidence in this case gets there any place. Judge Sharp found in his ruling that even assuming that the comments of Kevin Pastrick might have been unfortunate, they in no way led to the arrest of Mr. Morphin. They had nothing to do with the arrest of Mr. Morphin. In fact, the arrest of Mr. Morphin took place only after Kovacs was on the phone with his advisor, and only after he saw what Mr. Morphin was doing. Thank you, sir. I hope we've answered all your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Greco. Mr. Bodensteiner?
Very briefly, Your Honor. I think the last comment about Judge Sharp's finding is basically the problem in this case. That is that Judge Sharp made findings when he shouldn't be making findings. Secondly...
But can we stay with Kevin Pastrick for a second?
Yes.
What do we have as to his ability to influence other than the son of?
Well, I think that's the critical part. The other part of it is the one way you could view the evidence here is that he's in there not only with respect to Morphin, but with respect to French, and he's urging this cop to make the arrest. Get him out of here. Justin says arrest him. And you have a cop who doesn't know what to do, and you have the mayor's son there telling him to do this.
But is there any showing that he actually had any authority over the police officers other than just being the mayor's son?
He didn't have any legal authority.
Right. Is there any other kind of authority he has?
I think, no. I mean, not by law. His authority is that he's in there, as he said, looking out for his father's interests, urging the police to make an arrest of the official who by law has primary jurisdiction over this scene.
What didn't make any reference to his father when he made these comments?
No. No, but he was known to be the mayor's son.
The record shows that the officer knows he's the mayor's son.
I don't know that the officer said that, but the impression you got from all the depositions is that Kevin Pastrick was well known among everyone on the scene.
Well, you think that's a jury question that how well known the mayor's child is or son is?
Not how well known he is, but in this situation, I don't think there was, no one is arguing or has argued, or nor did Judge Sharp find that Kovacs didn't know Kevin Pastrick was the mayor's son.
Is that the burden, that the record should show that Kovacs didn't know, or should it be the plaintiff's burden to establish that Kovacs didn't know?
Well, even whether or not he actually knew, I mean, if he's influenced by this individual who is exhorting...
Well, you're talking about attenuated. What if the mayor's son just drives around all the time on election day from poll to poll, and Kovacs sees him outside? No conversation, but he feels, quote, his presence. Are we? Would that be too attenuated?
Well, I think his driving around would not be enough. I think he has to take some affirmative action in terms of pushing the police in order to be held liable.
And the district court didn't find that Kovacs knew he was the mayor's son, right?
Did not make that finding, no, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Bone Center. All right, thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under... excuse me, 1 second.
No, I just shook my hand in agreement with you.
Oh, okay.
Lawyers.
Okay. Yeah, thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.